Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Oh no, I've done the thing where I don't have any of my pages open. Damn it. Well, talk amongst yourselves whilst I... No, hang on. You know what happened today? Today, I ate a lemon. And all my life, I thought you just can't eat a lemon. I always thought, like, I love lemon. I would eat a lemon. But no, you can't eat a lemon. It's too sour, right? You can't eat a lemon. Turns out that was just society trying to tell me what I can't do. I woke up with a sore throat, right? Right now I'm sipping. If you heard that sip, that's a honey lemon tea, what I've just made myself. Oh, it's good. I woke up with a sore throat, and I have heaps of lemons in the house, because, you know, I live in the Yarra Valley, and whenever someone says, hey, do you want some lemons? I've got a lot of them. I'll say, yeah, I'll take a lot of them, and then they'll bring me a lot of lemons, because I get through them. I love them. Lemon water, lemon tea, that kind of thing. But I would never just eat a slice of lemon, or just eat a lemon like you would an orange. I just thought you couldn't. I thought you couldn't do that. It was off the cards. It was off the table. And about a week ago, my brother gave me these lemonade lemons, he called them. He works at a very fancy winery estate thing, vineyard, multi-bajillion dollar estate. He's like a groundskeeper, and he always brings, you know, fruits and stuff back from their trees. He said, this is a lemonade lemon tree, and they're kind of in between a lemon and a mandarin. If you know what a mandarin is, I'm sure you do. They've got some other weird name in America. I think they call them something different, but we call them mandarins. And he said, yeah, you can just eat them like a mandarin. They're a little bit sour, but they're basically like a sweeter, less sour lemon. And I've been sitting on my bench for a while. And then with the sore throat this morning, I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm going to eat some good citrus things and that'll be really soothing. So I ate one. And it was so good. It was so good. And then I ate another one. And it was beautiful. And then I was like, I'm going to eat some normal lemon. So I cut up a normal lemon and ate it. And it was delicious. So I feel angry at just the world at large for me being 33 and for 33 years thinking that you can't just eat a lemon. And then I've just discovered that you can. And holy shit, it's awesome. Now that mandarin lemon was probably a little bit easier to eat because it wasn't as sour. It had a really good amount of sour. But still, the real lemon, yeah, delicious. So that's a little story for you while I open up my pages. While I was telling that story, I forgot to open up my pages because I got carried away talking about lemons. We're talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Book 12, Chapter 5. we're so close to the end here, guys. We're so close to the end. It is very exciting. Sorry, I'm doing seven things at once, getting all my stuff ready to talk to you all. Okay, I think I'm good. Oh, no, I went and opened the book. Nope, the book's open. All right, we're ready to roll. Good podcasting. All right. What did Katerina just do? That was the question I asked you guys. Oh, I'm having like a thing with that cup of lemon honey tea. It's going down so well. Swim said the mama fishy said, Katerina, you personify this quote. Heaven has no rage like love to hatred turned. Hell, nor hell a fury like a woman scorned. William Congreve. You know, I'm sure that William Congreve quote had the word hath in there, right? Hath. Or did people just add that to be fancy? Also, I finally obtained a copy of Joseph Frank's biography of Dostoevsky. He had this to say about Ivan. The devil arrives to personify Ivan's self-mockery of his own moral psychic contradictions, which have driven him into what Dostoevsky called brain fever, and we now diagnose as schizophrenia. Schizophrenic. What do they call it? There's another word for it now. Schizophrenic. What is it? It's something disorder. Anyway, okay, I'm not going to go down the Google rabbit hole. Okay, wow, he's schizophrenic. Well, we kind of knew that, didn't we? Modern science has shown that these kinds of mental illnesses do tend to manifest in males in their early 20s. I personally know two young men where this is true, although in this case, I believe Dostoevsky is using mental illness as a plot device. So schizophrenia is a paranoid... It's I can't remember the name of it, but I was talking to my friend James, who is the psychology professor, and he was saying that it's a progression from like paranoid schizophrenia. It starts as like paranoia or neuroticism sort of thing. It can develop to full blown schizophrenia, and it's usually. Some people, it was always going to happen. Other people, it kind of lays dormant, and it might never happen, but it can be triggered by things like extreme stress, drugs, alcohol, trauma, etc. And you know what? I think that is a thing in my family. There's been a little bit of schizophrenic sort of paranoid things going on throughout. Like if I look up my family tree. To like distant relatives, not really ones that I know, but ones that have, you know, come before me, and this is kind of like a mythology around them that they did this or that. And I've always had that feeling, like I think it's a dormant thing in me, where if I got pushed in the wrong way, or if I got hooked on drugs or something like that, I could see it developing. I could see it becoming a thing. And I think that's how it works. Anyway, and then the next level after that is the psychotic episodes. So schizophrenic people will eventually have psychotic episodes, and that's like the ultimate manifestation of their illness. That's how I'm led to believe it anyway. I'm pretty sure that's what James sort of described. I might be getting that wrong. I'd love to ask James about that actually, and get his actual response, because I'm kind of paraphrasing what I remember, and I'm pretty sure that's what he said. Anyway, so me saying he was having, psychotic episodes, maybe he was, if he's schizophrenic, he might have been. Although in this case, I believe Dostoevsky is using mental illness as a plot device. Brain fever, says I Am Norwegian, was a very common plot device at the time, and particularly in Dostoevsky's work, Brain Fever. What a plot device that is. Oh, he's gone crazy. He's got brain fever. Now we can do some cool psychedelic devil things and whatever. Is this what Katerina refers to as shivers? Illness is definitely a theme with Dosto. Oh, this is Techrific's comment now, by the way. Techrific said, is this what Katerina refers to as shivers? Illness is definitely a theme with Dosto. Crime is associated with becoming ill. Or more precisely, after a crime has been perpetrated, the criminal falls ill. Supposedly from guilt. Raskolnikov is a great example, but I hadn't heard it in connection with the victims of crime too. Very informative, thanks. Yeah, I've never known someone to be so guilty that they get sick. In fact, people don't even really seem to feel guilt anymore, do they? Do they? Have you ever known someone to be racked with guilt? Now people are more racked with things like worry or paranoia or... I don't know. I don't think people are as ashamed of themselves or as guilty as they used to be. I don't know why I'm saying that. I Am Norwegian said, man, Ivan's speech was great. It felt almost cinematic, like I could have seen it in my head much more clearly than most other scenes in the book. I also wanted to compare it to something like Tyrion's confession in Game of Thrones, but Ivan wasn't exactly coherent. Still, he revealed how the crowd simply exploited the case as entertainment. The crowd wants to revel in the blood and misery. And Ivan told the truth. He did what he promised to do and redeemed his moral character. This is the first time I've seen a dramatic court scene where someone bursts in with a critical piece of evidence and it has no effect on anything. Katerina giving the money to Mitya, knowing that he wouldn't send it and that instead it would be squandered, is a pretty huge revelation. She lit the powder keg's fuse. What did Katerina just do? She sealed Dmitri's fate. His only hope of escaping Siberia now is Ivan's plan. Not that that is looking so good now, either. Ivan is in no shape to plan a prison escape. Somastar says, I find this interesting because, as I understand it, Dostoevsky partly wrote Ivan's character as he did because he wanted to portray the pitfalls of such thinking. But yet, here we have Ivan, the only person on the witness stand telling the truth. And it is everyone else in the courtroom who cannot hear what he is saying and labelling him mad. How does this meet Dostoevsky's goal in structuring Ivan's character and thinking as an incorrect approach to life? It's a good question. The schizophrenic person is drawing links, right? Drawing lines in their mind between things. They're kind of searching for patterns. They're searching for coincidences. They're trying to piece everything together, right? So they're on this, their brain's actually processing stuff really, really fast. And they're trying to make sense of everything. So they're actually, it's like they're trying to do this big puzzle, which is the whole world. And so they're making connections. So they're actually seeing things very, very clearly, the schizophrenic person. But the thing that happens is it kind of goes into haywire. It goes into overdrive, this connection-making thing, and they start making connections that aren't there. So very tenuous links. They start to think, oh, why did they say that? Are they hinting at this? Or, oh, they just blinked twice. They must definitely know something. And they start like linking all these things together. They make connections that aren't there because their minds are hyper vigilant. And so they actually, it's weird because they feel like they're seeing things very, very clearly, because for the most part they are, but then there's this overlayer of things where they're making all these connections, all these coincidences that are too much of a stretch. Like, they're not actually real coincidences, they're just things they've linked up in their own mind. And that's where it becomes the problem, I suppose. And that's why, where was it? That's why Ivan told the truth. What was it? What did you say? Let me read this comment one more time, some stars. Find it interesting. He's, by the way, he's referring to the part of the above, the previous comment by I Am Norwegian. Ivan told the truth. He did what he promised to do and redeemed his moral character. I find this interesting because, as I understand it, Dostoevsky partly wrote Ivan's character as he did because he wanted to portray the pitfalls of such thinking, but yet here we have Ivan, the only person on the witness stand telling the truth. And it is everyone else in the courtroom who cannot hear what he is saying and labelling him mad. How does this meet Dostoevsky's goal of structuring Ivan's character and thinking he has an incorrect approach to life? So, he is telling the truth. That's not where his fault is. His fault is that kind of over-hyperactivity of his conscience or his mind. I'm going to sneeze. Oh, that was a good sneeze. I'm sick, by the way. I don't know if if I mentioned that. Alright. What was I saying? Anyway, that's something like how I see the paranoid schizophrenic person. I'm interested in this at the moment because the main character in the book that I'm writing is having a psychotic episode as a result of kind of severe paranoia and stress and trauma. And so I kind of have been studying this whole phenomena. I feel like I know a lot about it. I probably don't, though. I Am Norwegian says, maybe he has already illustrated his character and thinking is as incorrect. The arc might have been over the moment he picked up the person lying in the snow. It depends on what happens in the last 15% of the book. I'm not sure if Ivan is going to change as a character or if he'll die from guilt and cognitive dissonance. Can you die from cognitive dissonance? So, in the previous comment, there was another thing that struck me. How does this meet Dostoevsky's goal in structuring Ivan's character and thinking as an incorrect approach to life? So, the problem with that type of writing is that he's setting out to make a point. Like, he already believes that this mode of being that Ivan inhabits, embodies, is incorrect. And he's writing a book to prove that. So, he's writing with a point, with a lesson in mind. And I think, I don't know, I think you need a bit more open than that in your writing. You can't really, I think if you start a book trying to prove a point, then you're just going to prove that point. Whereas if you write it to explore an idea, especially in like a philosophical sense or a psychological sense, then you're going to actually discover something. But if you're just trying to prove something, then it's fiction, so you'll just make the things happen that suit the point you're trying to make. And then just save us all the time and just tell us your opinion then, right? Just say, oh, hey, I reckon it's a bad way to live to be a paranoid schizophrenic. Cool. Is that it? Is that the point? Yeah. Cool. I would agree. I would agree. Do I still have to read 700 boring pages? No? No, that's the whole point you make? Okay. Cool. Just say that then. If that's all you're trying to say in the whole book is just to prove that point, just say that point. Like, if you're not actually trying to explore the idea, you're just trying to, like, just manufacture. It's like you're manufacturing your own proof of a theory, but it's fiction. So it's like, oh, yeah. I have this idea, and look at this work of fiction. It proves my idea. It doesn't. It just proves you're an idiot. Uncle Josmeyer said, that was a trick I didn't expect and caught me by surprise. In the chapter before, when we believed that Katya was going to show Mitch's letter, she gave us instead a discreet testimony that favoured Dimitri's case. We all breathed a sigh of relief because we believed the danger for Mitcher had passed already. Even the audience was disappointed because the so expected conflict between Katya and Grushenka didn't throw a spark. But when we were off guard, all the tension exploded out of the blue in a second and the unleashed passions and the letter wreak havoc. Well played. Laura Weistich said, it did seem like Dimitri was out of danger, but the narrator kept warning us that something would destroy him was coming. Yeah, good point, Laura. Laura Weistich. That is a good point, that the narrator did keep saying, like, Dimitri's downfall or Dimitri's demise before the twist was revealed. So, two or three chapters ago, we knew he was going down because the narrator kept telling us. So, I don't really know how anyone was surprised that in the end he got screwed over, because we'd already been... They kind of spoiled that two or three chapters ago. Anyway, let's keep moving and read the next chapter, which goes for 2, 4, 6, 8 pages. Can you hear the genuine disappointment in my voice when I find out it's a long chapter and I have to read 8 stupid pages of this bad book? I'm really enjoying this tea, though. I've nearly finished it. Sorry about all the sips of drinking on this episode. I usually try not to, like, take too many sips of drink while I'm podcasting, because I know it's kind of annoying, but tonight I'm just going for it. Oh, it's so good. Chapter 6, The Prosecutor's Speech, Sketches of Character. Ippolit Kirillovich began his speech trembling with nervousness, with cold sweat on his forehead. Really? Feeling hot and cold all over by turns. Isn't that a little... Why is every everything that someone does is just like dialed up to an 11. Like, maybe like he began his speech nervously. That will be fine, but trembling with nervousness, with cold sweat on his forehead, feeling hot and cold all over by turns. Isn't that a little much? And every description of every character is like, they screamed, they sprinted across the room, they hurled themselves onto the couch. Everything's just so dramatic and over the top. It's almost like it's shit writing. He described this himself afterwards. He regarded this whole speech as his chef d'oeuvre, the chef d'oeuvre of his whole life, as his swan song. He died, it is true, 9 months later of rapid consumption, so that he had the right, as it turned out, to compare himself to a swan singing his last song. Well, if that isn't overdramatic, I don't know what is. He had put his whole heart, the swan song, he never sung his whole life, but as he died, he sung the most beautiful song in his final moments. And that's what this speech was, this unknown character made in a trial that no one cares about. He had put his whole heart and all the brain he had into that speech. He put all the brain he had into that speech. And poor Ippolit Kirillovich unexpectedly revealed that at least some feeling for the public welfare and the eternal question lay concealed in him. Where his speech really excelled was in its sincerity. He genuinely believed in the prisoner's guilt. He was accusing him not as an official duty only, and in calling for vengeance he quivered with a genuine passion for the security of society. Even the ladies in the audience with two E's, though they remained hostile to Ippolit Kirillovich, admitted that he made an extraordinary impression on them. He began in a breaking voice, but it soon gained strength and filled the court to the end of his speech. But as soon as he had finished, he almost fainted. But as soon as he had finished, comma, he almost fainted. Gentlemen of the jury, began the prosecutor, this case has made a stir throughout Russia, but what is there to wonder at? What is there so peculiarly horrifying in it for us? We are so accustomed to such crimes. That's what's so horrible, that dark, such dark deeds have ceased to horrify us. We ought to horrify... Oh my God, I'm halfway through the first page, I don't know if I can read this. What ought to horrify us is that we are so accustomed to it, and not that this is that isolated crime. What are the causes of our indifference, our lukewarm attitude to such deeds, to such signs of the times, ominous of an unenviable future? Is it our cynicism? Is it the premature exhaustion of intellect and imagination in a society that is sinking into decay in spite of its youth? Is it that our moral principles are shattered to their foundations, or is it perhaps a complete lack of such principles among us? I cannot answer such questions, nevertheless they are disturbing, and every citizen not only must but ought to be harassed by them. Yep, God is dead, we get it. Our newborn and still timid press has done good service to the public already, for without it we should never have heard of the horrors of unbridled violence and moral degradation which are continually made known by the press, not merely to those who attend the new jury courts established in the present reign, but to everyone. And what do we read almost daily? Oh, it's so boring. It's so boring. It's like getting into an ice bath of boredom. It's unbearable. And what do we read almost daily? Of things beside which the present case grows pale and seems almost commonplace, but what is most important is that the majority of our national crimes of violence bear witness to a widespread evil, now so general among us that it is difficult to contend against it. One day we see a brilliant young officer of high society at the very outset of his career, in a cowardly, underhand way, without a pang of conscience, murdering an official who had once been his benefactor and the servant girl to steal his own IOU, and what ready money he could find on him. Are you just recapping the book? It will come in handy for my pleasures in the fashionable world and for my career in the future. After murdering them, he puts pillows under the head of each of his victims. He goes away. Next, a young hero decorated for bravery kills the mother of his chief and benefactor like a highwayman, and to urge his commanders to join him and asserts that she loves him like a son, and he shall follow directions to take no precautions. Granted that he is a monster, yet I dare not say in these days that he is unique. Another man will not commit the murder, but he will feel and think like him and is as dishonorable as in soul. In silence, alone with his conscience, he asks himself, perhaps, what is honour, and isn't the condemnation of bloodshed a prejudice? Perhaps people will cry out against me that I am a morbid, hysterical, that it is a monstrous slander, that I am exaggerating. Let them say so, and heavens, I should be the first to rejoice if it were so. Oh, don't believe me, think of me as morbid, but remember my words, if only a tenth, if only a 20th part of what I say is true, even so it's awful. Look how young people commit suicide without asking themselves Hamlet's question, what there is beyond, without a sign of such a question, as though all that relates to the soul and that to what awaits us beyond the grave had long been erased in their minds and buried under the sands. Look at our vice, at our profligates, Fyodor Pavlovich, the luckless victim in the present case was almost an innocent babe compared with many of them, and yet we all knew him, he lived among us. This is someone's speech in the court. Like, someone's just standing in the court and saying all this stuff. And there's a whole audience just listening. I can picture it, sure. In berserk land, where nothing makes sense. Yes, one day perhaps the leading intellects of Russia and of Europe will study the psychology of Russian crime, for the subject is worth it. But this study will come later at leisure, when all the tragic topsy-turvydom of today is further behind us, so that it's possible to examine it with more insight and more impartiality than I can do. Now we are either horrified or pretend to be horrified, sorry, though we really gloat over the spectacle and love strong and eccentric sensations with which tickle our cynical, pampered illness. That weird voice, I squeezed my voice box. Like my Adam's apple while I was talking for some reason. I don't know why I did it. Out of boredom, I did it. That's why I did it. Out of boredom. Or like little children, we brush the dreadful ghosts away and hide our heads in the pillow. So there's a judge just sitting with his hammer, just listening to this in a court case. We brush the dreadful ghosts away and hide our heads in the pillow, so as to return to our sports and merriment as soon as they have vanished. But we must one day begin life in sober earnest. We must look at ourselves as a society. It's time we tried to grasp something of our social position, or at least to make a beginning in that direction. A great writer, Gogol, of the last epoch, comparing Russia to a swift troika galloping to an unknown goal, exclaims, "Oh, troika, bird-like troika, who invented thee?" And adds in proud ecstasy that all the peoples of the world stand aside respectfully to make way for the recklessly galloping troika to pass. That may be, they may stand aside respectfully or no, but in my poor opinion, the great writer ended his book in a way, either in an excess of childish and naive optimism or simply in fear of censorship of the day. For if the troika were drawn by his heroes, Sobakovich, Nozdryov, Chichikov, it would reach no rational goal, whoever might be driving it, and those were the heroes of an older generation. Ours are worse specimens still. There's still just a judge just allowing this guy to say all this stuff. This random, barely on point stuff. And just allowing it. At this point, Ippolit Kirillovich's speech was interrupted by applause. Oh, fuck me. Applause. Not yawns. Not just confused, what kind of looks, like people just going, what? Applause. The liberal significance of this simile was appreciated. The applause was, it's true, a brief duration, so that the president did not think it necessary to caution the public and only look severely in the direction of the offenders. But Ippolit Kirillovich was encouraged. He had never been applauded before. He had been all his life unable to get a hearing, and now he suddenly had an opportunity of securing the ear of all of Russia. What, after all, is this Karamazov family, which has gained such an unenviable notoriety throughout Russia? He continued, why is this family notorious? They're a bunch of losers. Why does anyone know them, other than that one of them has some money? Perhaps I'm exaggerating, but it seems to me that certain fundamental features of the education class of today are reflected in this family picture, only, of course, in miniature, like the sun in a drop of water. Think of that unhappy, vicious, unbridled old man who has met with such a melancholy end, the head of a family. The head of a family. Where was I? The head of a family. Beginning life of noble birth, but in a poor, dependent position. Through an unexpected marriage, he came into a small fortune. A petty knave, a toady and buffoon, of fairly good, though undeveloped intelligence. He was above all a moneylender who grew bolder with growing prosperity. His abject and servile characteristics disappeared. His malicious and sarcastic cynicism was all that remained. On the spiritual side, he was underdeveloped, while his vitality was excessive. He saw nothing in life but sensual pleasure, and he brought his children up to be the same. He had no feelings for his duties as a father. He ridiculed those duties. He left his little children to the servants, and was glad to be rid of them, forgot about them completely. The old man's maxim was, "Après moi le déluge, after me the deluge." He was an example of everything that is opposed to civic duty, of the most complete and malignant individualism. The word may burn for aught I care, so long as I am all right. And he was all right. He was content. He was eager to go on living in the same way for another 20 or 30 years. He swindled his own son and spent his money, his maternal inheritance, on trying to get his mistress from him. No, I don't intend to leave the prisoner's defense altogether to my talented colleague from Petersburg. I will speak the truth myself. I can well understand that what resentment he had heaped up in his son's heart against him. But enough of that unhappy old man. He has paid the penalty. Let us remember, however, that he was a father, and one of the typical fathers of today. Am I unjust indeed in saying that he is a typical of many modern fathers? Alas, many of them only differ in not openly professing such cynicism, for they are better educated, more cultured, but their philosophy is essentially the same as his. Perhaps I am a pessimist, but you have agreed to forgive me. Let us agree beforehand. You need not believe me, but let me speak. Let me say what I have to say, and remember something of my words. Now, for the children of this father, this head of a family, one of them is the prisoner before us. All the rest of my speech will deal with him. Of the other two, I will speak only cursorily. The elder is one of those modern young men of brilliant education and vigorous intellect who has lost all faith in everything. He has denied and rejected much already, like his father. Why are you saying this in a court case? We have all heard him. He was a welcome guest in local society. He never concealed his opinions, quite the contrary, in fact, which justifies me in speaking rather openly of him now, of course, not as an individual, but as a member of the Karamazov family. Another persona closely connected with the case died here by his own hand last night. I mean an afflicted idiot, formerly the servant, and possibly the illegitimate son of Fyodor Pavlovich Smerdyakov. At the preliminary inquiry, he told me with hysterical tears how the young Ivan Karamazov had horrified him by his spiritual audacity. Everything in the world is lawful, according to him, and nothing must be forbidden in the future. That is what he always taught me. I believe that idiot was driven out of his mind by this theory, though, of course, the epileptic attacks from which he suffered and this terrible catastrophe have helped to unhinge his faculties. But he dropped one very interesting observation, which would have done credit to a more intelligent observer. That is, indeed, why I've mentioned it. If there is one of the sons that is like Fyodor Pavlovich in his character, it is Ivan Fyodorovich. With that remark, I conclude my sketch of his character, feeling the indelicate it indelicate to continue further. Oh, I don't want to draw any further conclusions, and croak like a raven over the young man's future. We've seen today in this court that there are still good impulses in his young heart. The family feeling has not been destroyed in him by lack of faith and cynicism, which have come to him rather by inheritance than by the exercise of independent thought. Then the third son, oh, he is a devout and modest youth who does not share his older brother's gloomy and destructive theory of life. He has sought to cling to the ideas of the people, or what goes by the name of some circles in our intellectual classes. He clung to the monastery and was within the ace of becoming a monk, and he seems to have been betrayed unconsciously and so early the timid despair which leads so many in our unhappy society to dread, who dread cynicism and incorrupting influences, and mistakenly attribute all the mischief to a European enlightenment, to return to their native soil as to say that to the bosom, so to speak, of their mother earth. Like frightened children yearning to fall asleep in the withered bosom of their decrepit mother and to sleep there forever only to escape the horrors that terrify them. For my part, I wish the excellent and gifted young man every success. I trust that youthful idealism and impulse towards the ideas of the people may never degenerate as often happens in the moral inside and the gloomy mysticism and on the political into the blind chauvinism. Two elements which are even of greater menace to Russia than the premature today due to the misunderstanding of a gratuitous adoption of the European ideas from which his older brother is suffering. Two or three people clapped their hands at the mention of his chauvinism and mysticism. Ippolit Kirillovich had been indeed carried away by his own eloquence. All this had little to do with the case in hand, so to say nothing of the fact that it's being somewhat vague. By the sickly and consumptive... Wait a minute. So the narrator just said, all this had little to do with the case in hand. And about 10 times in the previous few chapters, he's been saying how he's only going to say things that are relevant and cut out all the other bits. And after 4 pages of this speech, he says, all of this had little to do with the case in hand. I hate this book. This book is like an author just standing in front of you and giving you the middle finger for 15 hours with just like a cruel look of arrogant pleasure on their face, like, screw you, and you just have to stand there and be given the finger by this smug dickhead. That's what this book is. This book, like, the author doesn't want you to enjoy this book. I don't know how no one else can see that. All this had little to do with the case in hand, to say nothing of the fact of its being somewhat vague, but the sickly and consumptive man was overcome by the desire to express himself once in his life. People said afterwards that he was actuated by unworthy motives in his criticisms of Ivan, because the latter had on one or two occasions got the better of him in an argument, and Ippolit Kirillovich, remembering it, tried now to take his revenge. But I don't know whether it was true all this was only introductory, however, and the speech passed the more direct consideration of the case. But to return to the older son, Ippolit Kirillovich went on, he is the prisoner before us, he was alive in actions too before his fatal day, and the carmen was brought to surface. While his brother seemed to stand for Europeanism and the principles of the people, he seems to represent Russia as she is. Oh, not all Russia, not all. God preserve us if it were. Yet here we have her, our mother Russia, the very sentence out of her. Oh, he is spontaneous, he is marvellous, mingling of good and evil. He is a lover of culture and Schiller, yet he brawls in taverns and plucks out the beards of his boon companions. Oh, he too can be good and noble, but only when all goes well for him. What is more, he can be carried off his feet, positively carried off his feet by noble ideals, but only if they come of themselves. If they fall from heaven for him, if they need not be paid for. He dislikes paying for anything, but is very fond of receiving, and that's so what with him in everything. Oh, give him every possible good in life. He couldn't be content with less. And put no obstacle in his way, and he will show that he too can be noble. He too is not greedy, but he must show have money, a great deal of money, and you will see how generously with what scorns of filthy lucre and will fling all away in reckless dissipation of one night. But if he has not money, he will show what he is ready to do to get it when he is in great need of it. But all this later. Let us take events in their chronological order. But hey, all that stuff I just said, later. The stuff I just said, later. First, we have Before us, a poor abandoned child running about the backyard without boots on his feet. As our worthy and esteemed fellow citizen of foreign origin alas expressed it just now, I repeat it again, I yield no one the defence of the criminal. I am here to accuse him, but to defend him also. Yes, I too am human. I too can weigh the influence of home and childhood on the character. But the boy grows up and becomes an officer for the jewel of other reckless conduct. He is exiled to one of the remote frontier towns of Russia. There he would lead a wild life as an officer, and of course he needed money, money before all things. And so after prolonged disputes, he came to settlement with his father, and last 6,000 was sent to him. A letter is in his existence in which he practically gives up his claim to the rest and settles the conflict with his father over the inheritance of the payment of the 6,000. Then came his meeting with a young girl of lofty character and brilliant education. Oh, I do not venture to repeat the details. You have only just heard them. Honor, self-sacrifice were shown there, and I will be silent. The figure of young officer frivolous and profligate, doing homage to true nobility and a lofty ideal, was shown in a very sympathetic light before us, but the other side of the medal was unexpectedly turned to us immediately after in this very court. Again, I will not venture to conjecture why it happened so, but there was causes. The same lady bathed in tears and long concealed by lofty, generous motives. He and the girl's betrothed looked, which was insufferable from him for anyone, and knowing that he had already deceived her, he had deceived her, believing that she was bound to enjoy everything from him, even treachery. She intentionally offered 3,000 rubles, and clearly, too clearly, let him understand that she was offering him the money to deceive her. Well, will you take it or not? Are you not lost so to shame? Was the dumb question in her scrutinizing eyes. He looked at her, saw clear, appropriated the 3,000 conditionally, and squandered it in 2 days with the new objects of his affections. What are we to believe, then? The first legend of the young officer sacrificing his father in a noble impulse of generosity and doing the reverence and his fear to, and the other revolting picture as a rule between two extremes, one has to find the mean. But in the present case, this is not true. The probability is that the first case is a genuine noble and the second is genuinely based. And why? Because he was the borrowed crumbs of character. That's just what I am leading up to. A capable of combining the most incongruous contradictions and capable of the greatest heights and the greatest depths. Oh my God, give me a break. Remember the brilliant remark made by a young observer who has... So he just says, this is Dostoevsky. My characters have duality because that's in fashion at the moment. They can be two things at once. Oh, can they? Why don't you show us that instead of telling us? Ever heard of show, don't tell? Oh, no. I'll just have the narrator tell you that they are. The sense of their own degradation is essential to those reckless, unbridled natures of the sense of their lofty generation. And that's true. They need continually an unnatural mixture. Two extremes at the same moment, and they are miserable and dissatisfied, and their existence is incomplete. They are wide and wide as Mother Russia. They include everything and put up with everything. By the way, gentlemen, the jury anticipate things in little. Can you conceive that a man like that, on receiving such a sum in such a way, at the price of shame, such a disgrace, and utter degradation, could have been capable of that very day of setting apart half the sum that very day and sewing it up in a little bag, and would have had the firmness of character to carry it around with him and avoid temptation, neither in drunken debauchery in taverns, nor when he was lying in the country trying to get from God knows whom the money so essential to him to remove the object of his affection from being tempted by his father. But did he bring himself to touch that little bag? No, why? If only to avoid abandoning his mistress to the rival of whom he was so jealous. He would have been certain to have opened that bag and to have stayed at home to keep watch over her and to await the moment when she would say to him, "At last I am yours," and to fly with her far from their fatal surroundings. But no, he did not touch the talisman. And what is the reason he gives for it? The chief reason, as I have just said, was that he was, would I say, "I am yours, take me where you will." He might have the wherewithal to take her. But the first reason, in the prisoner's own words, was of little weight besides the second. "While I have that money on me," he said, "I am a scoundrel, not a thief, for I can always go to my insulted betrothed, and laying down half the sum I have fraudulently appropriated, I can always say to her, 'You see, I've squandered half your money and shown I am weak and immoral man, and, if you like, a scoundrel.' I use the prisoner's own expressions, but though I am a scoundrel, I am not a thief, for if I had been a thief, I should have brought you back this half of the money." No, you stole half of the money. "But should have taken..." You are a thief. It's so stupid. "But should have taken it as I did the other half." You can steal half of something. That's still stealing. A marvellous explanation. This frantic but weak man who could not resist the temptation of accepting the 3,000 rubles at the price of such disgrace. This very man suddenly develops the most stoic firmness and carries about 1,000 rubles without daring to touch it. Does that fit in at all with the characters we have analysed? No, I venture to tell you how the real Dmitri Karamazov would have behaved in such circumstances if he really had brought himself to put away the money. At the first temptation, for instance, to entertain the woman with whom he had already squandered half the money, he would have unpicked his little bag, have taken out some 100 rubles, for why should he have taken back precisely half the money, that is, 1,500 rubles? Why not 1,400? And could just as well have said then that he was not a thief, because he brought back 1,400 rubles, and then another time he would have unpicked it and taken out another 100, and then a third, and then a fourth, and then before the end of the month he would have taken the last note, but one, feeling that if he took back only 100 it would answer the purpose, for a thief would have stolen it all. And then he would have looked at this last note and have said to himself, it's really not worthwhile to give back 100, let's spend that too. That's how the real Dmitri Karamazov, as we know him, would have behaved. No one cannot imagine anything more incongruous with the actual fact that this legend of the little bag. Nothing could be more inconceivable, but we shall return to that later. After touching upon what had come out of the proceedings concerning the financial relations of the father and son, and arguing again and again, it was utterly impossible for the facts known to determine with which what is in wrong, Ippolit Kirillovich passed to the evidence of the medical experts in reference to Mitch's fixed idea about the 3,000 owing to him. All right. There we go. That shit, that piece of shit that I just read was apparently a speech that a man was so proud of having made that 9 months later, he just was like, my life's not getting any better than that speech, and he died because of that speech. All right? And I'm not, like, it sounds like I'm trying to make up the corniest thing, but that's what the book said earlier in the chapter. That's the level of book we're dealing with here. That speech was so good that the man died. If this book was meant to be a comedy, 10 out of 10. Because that shit is hilarious. But it's not meant to be funny. We're meant to take that seriously. Good luck to you guys. Have your say over at Reddit. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.